Welcome to Scaring America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. China, as is often the case, is top of mind at the moment. It is undergoing internal challenges, but also engaging increasingly in belligerent activities, not just in the Western Pacific, but there especially. It is also, as ever, engaged in unrestricted warfare against us, the subject of our book, The Indictment, prosecuting the Chinese Communist Party and friends for crimes against America, China, and the world. And we talk at length about the myriad lines of attack in which the Chinese are engaged, aimed at elevating themselves and not just reducing our status, but ultimately destroying our country. Few people on planet Earth outside of the Chinese Politburo understand what they are up to better than our next guest. I'm proud to say he is a friend as well as a very valued colleague. His name is Gordon G. Chang. No stranger to our program, I'm proud to say, but a man that has studied closely what the Chinese are up to and has a very keen sense of where it's likely to go next. And it's always a privilege to be able to catch up with him. He's the author, among other things, of The Coming Collapse of Communist China. He is one of our duty experts that we rely upon, writing prolifically at the Gatestone Institute, at Epoch Times, Newsweek, and elsewhere, and I'm proud to say, visiting with us. Gordon, it's good to have you back. Welcome, sir.
Thank you so much, Frank.
So, Gordon, I have to start with an issue that is kind of a microcosm of the larger problem of unrestricted warfare. Its brilliance, its lethality, its, I would guess, sort of unsurpassed success in penetrating our country is something that too few Americans grasp. And frankly, too many Americans have been seduced by. I'm talking about TikTok. This is very much top of mind at the moment here in Washington because the Congress is debating what to do about TikTok. Talk to me about the nature of this social media platform, in fact, as well as the service that it provides the Chinese Communist Party.
TikTok is a mobile video sharing app. It's short videos. And it has been able to do two things with TikTok. So it's two primary national security threats. First of all, it's been stealing the data from Americans. There's 170 million TikTok users in the U.S. That's almost half the American population. Although the TikTok CEO on January 31st testified to the Senate that TikTok has never supplied data to Beijing, it has been documented so many times that it in fact has. But the bigger threat is that Beijing uses the video sharing app really to propagate its narratives. So for instance, Chinese communist propaganda on Hamas, on Ukraine, promotion of illegal drug use, promotion of self-harm. These are all sorts of things that get big play in TikTok. So really it is China's propaganda weapon to the United States. And I think that the curation algorithm, which is really the propaganda issue, is the more important of the two.
And when you say propaganda, Gordon, a feature of it, as I understand it, is really not only the kind of personal problematic things you've mentioned, but also this idea that America is a loathsome place that, should be reviled by young people in this country. And the Chinese, system by contrast is to be admired. Is this just a subliminal phenomenon, or is this even more overt than that? And what are we seeing in terms of its manifestations?
We're getting these videos because of the curation algorithm. That's the algorithm that decides what to send to your children and also what not to send. And because it is extremely sophisticated, perhaps the most sophisticated curation algorithm in the world, it has made TikTok incredibly addictive, which is the reason why it has 170 million users. So it is definitely part of it. And you got to remember that in the last days of the Trump administration, when they were trying to force a sale to Oracle, that sale floundered not on price, but on control of the algorithm, which shows you what Beijing really wants out of TikTok. It wants to destroy the United States. That's Beijing's plan. And they come out and say it. They declared us to be an enemy, and they're working very hard to that. I mean, just to give you an example, TikTok, like every other platform, will have a community standard that prohibits the promotion of illegal drug use. But on TikTok, you can find videos with millions of hits that do precisely that. And so that is one of Beijing's plan, to destroy a generation with drugs. And so it's no accident that these videos remain on the platform despite the community standard. Now, we can go into issues of self-harm. We can go into issues of trying to derail President Trump's re-election campaign in 2020. You know, there's a whole range of things, but it is no accident that TikTok promotes these things that Beijing wants. And it actually is very effective in stopping videos that Beijing doesn't like.
Right. The kinds of videos they won't allow to be seen in China, for example. Right. Gordon, let me ask you about one other aspect of this that is kind of further evidence of the weaponization of TikTok. And that is the use by the Chinese Communist Party of the platform to encourage particularly young people, not necessarily people who would otherwise be interested in the Middle East, to pour into demonstrations on college campuses and in the streets of American cities, essentially to support Hamas. Give us your take on what that suggests about the power of this platform to really move people from just self-harm or self-preoccupation of a very, you know, subversive form, but into a kind of possibly fifth column
operation. Well, analysts who have looked at this have said that something like over 96% of the videos on the Middle East support Hamas on TikTok. And that gives you an example of the power of the curation algorithm. You know, people have speculated that how could the George Floyd protests spring up around the U.S. In such obviously coordinated fashion? Well, the answer is because of devices, of platforms like TikTok. You just run through these issues. We have seen studies that have shown that right after Russia invaded Ukraine, that TikTok was used to spread Russian disinformation about that war. So, you know, it is all of these important issues to Beijing that find that TikTok, they use TikTok to promote their views and to shut out views that they don't like on these issues.
Yeah, I think in short, it's fair to say weaponizing this thing that's best known for silly dance videos that is an actual serious and material threat to our country. Gordon, on the other side of a short break, I want to just ask you what we should do about it in your estimation. We'll be right back with more with Gordon Chang right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, an overwhelming bipartisan majority of the House of Representatives voted to ban TikTok in the U.S. unless Americans control it rather than the Chinese Communist Party. The action followed a classified briefing for members about what TikTok actually is, namely an instrument of information warfare the CCP wields relentlessly to addict, propagandize, spy on, and increasingly weaponize our kids and adult countrymen. While the secret information shared is not available, a riveting committee on the presentation China webinar yesterday revealed that TikTok is, quote, digital fentanyl, unquote, that seriously threatens U.S. national security as well as its addicts. TikTok's lobbyists and millions of U.S. users will heed CCP demands to kill this bill in the Senate. The exercise will confirm that America has allowed our mortal enemy to create a generation or two of Manchurian voters. We must start unhooking them now. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We are visiting with Gordon Chang. I hope that you will follow him as I do at Gordon G. Chang. You can also follow him in a number of other outlets, notably the Gatestone Institute, terrific outfit. He is a senior fellow there. Gordon, we've been talking about TikTok, and I just wanted to conclude with one final question. Congress, President Trump, the Biden administration and others are wrestling with what to do about what is, as you've, I think, persuasively argued, a serious problem inside our country. President Trump has basically said, well, it's not as bad as Facebook, and Facebook would benefit if we did something about TikTok. But what's your suggestion, sir, as to what should be done about this weapon in the arsenal of the Chinese Communist?
House legislation, which will be voted on soon, would give TikTok a half year in order to sell itself to an American party. And that's a move in the right direction. But the more important thing is not just the sale of the interest in TikTok, but it's also control of the algorithm. Because in the last days of the Trump administration, when the president was trying to force a sale of TikTok to Oracle, the deal floundered, not over price, but over control of the algorithm. So we've got that's because that is the primary national security threat, in my view. Control of the algorithm is important, and we should expropriate it. This is something that has been used to attack the U.S. We should not allow China to own that. The other thing is that, you know, you don't need congressional legislation to force a sale of TikTok. The president can do it with the authority under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977. So this doesn't require congressional legislation. Now, it's good that President Biden said that he would sign the TikTok bill if it gets to his desk. And it was wrong for President Trump to post on Truth Social that, you know, basically he's against a forced sale of TikTok. Yes, he's true. He's right in the sense that a ban of TikTok would help Facebook. But the remedy for that is not to allow China to continue to attack us with TikTok, but to deal with the big social media platforms in our country in ways which are appropriate, which again is a much extended conversation. So this is something that is absolutely essential. One other thing, Frank, you know, people like Rand Paul say this is a First Amendment issue. Well, it's absolutely not a First Amendment issue. It's not about the content on the platform. It's about the conduct of TikTok itself. And so China does not have a First Amendment right to destroy the U.S. It's as simple as that. And conservatives and free speech advocates, they need to understand the First Amendment does not apply in this particular situation. We're not banning content. We are looking at what China is doing with the platform.
Amen. And as you have now said repeatedly, that algorithm in their hands is an instrument of our destruction. And that's certainly not protected by the First Amendment.
Absolutely.
Gordon, let me turn to another topic because, again, we rely on you to stay abreast of what is happening inside China. And there's obviously considerable political as well as economic turmoil there. Was that evident in the Chinese People's Congress that met recently? And I guess was consumed with the affairs of state. Were they addressed? And are there any signs that they are taking corrective action for some of the real challenges that they're facing?
Yeah. The annual meeting of the National People's Congress just wrapped up. That is the highest organ of state power in China. That's the central government, as opposed to the Communist Party. And it is described as the rubber stamp legislature, which is accurate. But it's important because this meeting, which occurs once a year in March, along with another session, which is the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, it's called the two sessions. This really is a window on what the Communist Party wants to do in the coming year. And we saw there were a number of things that I think were important out of it. But let me just focus on one of them. And that is the Chinese economy is in distress. I had been expecting the party to actually talk in a very substantive way about what they were going to do to rescue the economy. We didn't get that at the MPC meeting. What we got was two things. One of them was we got the one minister talk about how big property companies that should die will die, which was really interesting, which means they have no solution for the property sector. But it's clear that Xi Jinping does not want to stimulate consumption. Now, every economist outside of Beijing tells us that that's exactly what has to do for China to have a self-sustaining economy. Xi Jinping doesn't like that. He thinks it makes the society soft. So his program is to concentrate on manufacturing, especially what he calls new quality productive forces. In other words, high technology. In other words, he wants to export his way out of China's problems. And that means he's put his future in our hands, because we can deny him access to our market if we choose to do that, which obviously we should do.
Yeah, we certainly should. Gordon, this is probably a pretty elementary level question, but based on what you just said, that the National People's Congress is the highest organ of the government, and then you made the point that it's not the Chinese Communist Party, how do the two interface? And isn't really the government of China the party?
And Mao Zedong, when he took over China, it was basically the only thing that had mattered was the Communist Party. Deng Xiaoping, his successor, wanted to institutionalize and normalize the government. So Deng promoted the central government to be sort of not independent, but to be a separate source of governance. Under Xi Jinping, he's gone back to the party dominating everything. So the central government has become far less important. And this was made graphically clear because at the start of the NPC, they announced that the premier, Li Qiang, who is the head of the state council, in other words, he's the head of the central government, would not be giving his traditional post-NPC press conference, which has been held since 1993. So it really shows that Xi Jinping has put the party in a not only a predominant position over the central government, which has always been the case, but he's basically eliminating the central government as an independent institution. That's a little bit of an exaggeration, but not too much.
Well, it actually tracks with what I thought. And this would presumably, the diminishing of the role of the premier would also reflect a further consolidation of power in the person of Xi Jinping, would you say?
Great question. And yeah, the answer is yes, but we have been seeing signs of political instability. And these signs are not consistent with Xi Jinping becoming more powerful. We don't know exactly what's going on because the regime has become more opaque under Xi Jinping, especially over the last 2 or 3 years. But we are seeing signs that Xi is somewhat losing his grip on things. or in the alternative, that Xi Jinping is actually becoming a paranoid like Stalin and is attacking his own people. It's a very serious situation. The reason is we see people who were appointed by Xi Jinping not long ago being sacked by Xi Jinping. Either somebody else is doing it, his enemies, or Xi, as I said, become Stalin.
Yeah. A fascinating subject. This is where, you know, the art of Kremlinology got started, and it's now practiced, of course, trying to monitor the developments inside the Forbidden Palace in China. And we appreciate your acumen in all of these respects, Gordon. I know it's through a glass darkly, as they say, a lot of the time, but we appreciate you visiting with us to clarify as much as we can who's on first in communist China, and where are they taking the country, and what will it mean for us? God bless you, my friend. Keep up the great work. Come back to us again soon, if you would. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back. When I get to say welcome to our next guest, it's always a very, very high privilege as well as a distinct pleasure. His name is Peter McElvenna. He is the right-hand man of a member of the House of Lords by the name of Malcolm Pearson, who I admire tremendously. He and Peter run a very important, well, I guess think tank, you might call it. I think it is a freedom fighter outfit in the United Kingdom by the name of Hearts of Oak. And we're always very, very pleased, as I say, to catch up with Peter. Welcome back, my friend. Good to see you.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be with you.
I wanted to talk with you about a couple of things that are going down in the United Kingdom at the moment, and their perhaps larger import besides what is happening there in the UK. To start with, Peter, as you know, there is this ongoing war between Hamas, a designated terrorist organization, and an ally, the State of Israel. The United Kingdom, however, under its former prime minister and now foreign minister, David Cameron, seems to be taking the side of the designated terrorists. I would go so far as to say he's intent on saving Hamas. And if that means imperiling our ally, the Jewish state, so be it. Tell us if I'm wrong about that.
No, you're not wrong. We have seen a marked change over the years, probably in the closeness of the UK's relationship with Israel. And as our Conservative Party have become less conservative and lost a lot of their values, one of those values is a close association with Israel. And actually, it's this last weekend, we saw the police arresting a demonstrator who was protesting against the pro-Hamas, I cannot even say pro-Palestine, it is Hamas, because Hamas is the government and that's what the people there have accepted. So it is pro-Hamas demonstrations. We are seen in London probably every week, sometimes twice a week, with threats of violence outside Parliament, supposedly causing our MPs to fear for their very lives. And what do? The police turn a blind eye to these marches, these demonstrations, often calling for the eradication of Israel, and they arrest those who actually oppose this pro-Hamas, pro-Palestine, anti-Israel agenda. And this weekend, a man was carrying a sign saying about Hamas is illegal, or and he was actually arrested, even though Hamas are a proscribed organization in the UK or a terrorist organization, and yet the police arrested this individual for having the audacity to speak against Hamas.
This suggests something bigger is afoot, particularly in the capital city of Britain, London. Could this have something to do with the mayor and the demographics of that city now? And what does it tell us about the future? Well, prospects for maybe acts of violence, whether it's against the parliament or whether it's against His Majesty's government, or for that matter, the British citizenry more generally, at the hands of people who are not simply sympathetic to Hamas, but maybe willing to engage in their jihad as well.
Well, again, we have seen a change in the UK, the demographics change, and it is a phenomenon which has been called out by a number of individuals before, and that is the failure of Muslims to integrate in a Western society. And we are having ghettos all across the UK, especially in London, where supposedly multiculturalism is about integration, but it's not. It's about those silos, those ghettos, societies side by side, but completely separate. And what we are seeing is, look, Frank, it's exactly what you saw in Michigan in the vote, in the primaries, that you have a sizable, large Islamic grouping that is a block vote, that is a block voice, and parts of that community do verge on threats whenever they feel their right to practice whatever culture, whatever religion they want in a pluralistic society in the West. If that's encroached on, then there is the threat of violence. And that is what we are seeing. And you mentioned the mayor of London. We have Sadiq Khanna, a Muslim mayor, and a Muslim mayor probably represents the diversity of London. We are about 12-13% Muslim. With actually, across the UK, we have a 12% 0 to 15-year-old demographic, which is Muslim. So actually, that figure is going to rise substantially across the UK. And there is that incompatibility of the freedoms we enjoy in the West, Frank, to the freedoms in an Islamic society, which is null and void. And that lack of freedom is trying to be imposed on our culture, our society. And at a time where the church is falling down, is collapsing, Islam is rising, and it's concerning when you look ahead what that means, because obviously our authorities, our government, our police forces, our education system, our court system, they will all pander to this new force because they don't want to upset that, because if they do upset it, there could be violence and riots in the streets.
It's hard to overstate the importance of what you've just said, Peter. We're talking about, well, I think of it as Sharia supremacism that does not countenance accommodations to people who aren't, you know, imbued with, shall we say, a total commitment to adhere to this Islamic code that is, at its core, all about jihad. To be sure, it has a patina of religiosity to it, but it's fundamentally about power, how you get it through jihad, how you wield it, consistent with the most, well, barbaric norms of the 7th century under Muhammad. And the thing that is so alarming about this is that at, you know, 12% or maybe 15% or whatever it turns out to be in the not too distant future, given birth rates and so on within this community, it is imperiling, it seems, not just Britain's foreign policy towards Israel specifically, but indeed its internal security. And if you are, I'm sure, understating the case, watching the authorities turn a blind eye to this sort of thing in its present sort of pre-violent, but clearly leaning that way mode, this cannot end well, it would seem. And I know this is true of other nations in Europe. France is arguably even farther down the tubes, and the Netherlands and so on. But talk a little bit about, as you at Hearts of Oak and Malcolm Pearson see it now, whether there's any break on what is, you know, sort of evolving here.
I wish I could tell you yes, Frank, but at the moment I don't see it. We don't. The only break I see is actually in Europe, with the European parliamentary elections coming up in May and with populist parties on the right being on the ascendancy. And we just saw in Portugal, Chega party on the right took third place with 18% and has blown open Portuguese politics. And those parties are by and large pro-Israel. They're by and large concerned of the impact of Islam. So that is the huge bright spark we're seeing across Europe. But if you look back to the UK, we don't seem to have that opposition to what is happening. It is a lack of understanding of what it means to be British, or British values. And we say British values are tolerance, and that tolerance is confused to acquiesce. So we give away what we have in favor of whatever enters into that vacuum. That is what we're seeing at the moment, with a lack of backbone, a lack of courage, a lack of understanding of what it means to be British. And that is right from our politicians all the way up to King Charles, who of course is very open and pro-Islam.
Yeah, and makes no secret of it, does he? You know, speaking of David Cameron, I'm reminded that one of his predecessors, Tony Blair, very deliberately, we are told by some of his confidants, decided to punish the Tories, the Conservative Party, by opening the floodgates to Muslims from notably Pakistan and elsewhere, with a view to changing the demographics. This sounds a lot like what has been going on in our country too, with illegal immigration now blowing the doors off of what was left of our border. And I fear that we may be headed in the same direction if tolerance is confused with appeasement of people who wish us ill, not just Israel, but Judeo Christian civilization. We so appreciate what you do to stand against all of that in the UK and remind us what's at stake worldwide. Peter, we have about a minute left. Talk to me quickly about the latest evidence of the mistake that the United Kingdom made in surrendering Hong Kong to the Chinese Communist Party.
Well, of course, Britain surrendered Hong Kong because of fear of the Chinese, and we couldn't stand up. And that is the change of the world order. And we're kind of seeing a similar with Israel backing away because you have a new power there, which is the power of Islam in the Middle East. And again, once again, we see the UK backing away, and we don't have a military force any longer. We're a third-rate country in terms of military power, so we have no ability to defend any interests abroad. And of course, anything we've had have all been sent over to Ukraine. In any way. So we are bereft of that ability to defend ourselves plus defend our interests. And that is why we are walking away from our influence in the Middle East, as we did with our influence in Hong Kong.
Yeah. Well, this is a topic we'll return to on another occasion with you soon, I hope. The particular concern is the Chinese are continuing to ratchet up their pressure on Hong Kong with a new national security law. It's a tragedy. I was there when they surrendered Hong Kong, the Brits, and I bemoan what they're doing to it now. God bless you, my friend. My best to Lord Malcolm Pearson, and keep up your great work. And come back to us soon. We'll be right back.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, an overwhelming bipartisan majority of the House of Representatives voted to ban TikTok in the U.S. unless Americans control it rather than the Chinese Communist Party. The action followed a classified briefing for members about what TikTok actually is, namely an instrument of information warfare the CCP wields relentlessly to addict, propagandize, spy on, and increasingly weaponize our kids and adult countrymen. While the secret information shared is not available, a riveting committee on the present Danger China webinar yesterday revealed that TikTok is, quote, digital fentanyl, unquote, that seriously threatens U.S. national security, as well as its addicts. TikTok's lobbyists and millions of U.S. users will heed CCP demands to kill this bill in the Senate. The exercise will confirm that America has allowed our mortal enemy to create a generation or two of Manchurian voters. We must start unhooking them now. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to one of my friends and very, very esteemed colleagues at the Center for Security Policy. His name is Dr. David Wormser. He runs our Middle East program and brings to it a wealth of experience in senior positions throughout the United States government. He rose through the ranks of the United States Navy as an intelligence officer to the rank of Lieutenant Commander. He has also served with an Undersecretary of State, a National Security Advisor, and Vice President of the United States as one of their key advisors on the Middle East. We're always delighted to have him with us. David, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me.
So, a lot to talk with you about, David. We were just discussing in the previous segment with Peter McElvena, what seems to be happening in the United Kingdom, one of our close allies, also for many years, a close ally of the State of Israel. But it seems as though under the present government, specifically under its foreign minister, David Cameron, who has for many years been rather hostile, I think it's fair to say, towards Israel, if not downright anti-Semitic, Israel's friends in the United Kingdom seem to be fewer and farther between, and saving Hamas now seems to be the attitude of the British government. I want to talk with you about our own government in a moment, but any thoughts on whether that's overstating the case or a pretty accurate assessment? Yeah. Well, and hostility towards Israel has been, I guess, a kind of leitmotif of the Biden presidency, even before October 7th. And despite the, you know, professions of undying support for Israel, delivered no less in person by the president in Israel shortly after that attack, it certainly seems as though what, as you say, we're seeing the Brits do very publicly is being done, if a little less publicly, by the Biden team. And it's leading up, it would appear, to some unilateral decisions by the United States that are profoundly troubling. David, I want to talk with you about this port in a moment. But before we go there, the Biden administration seems now increasingly to be signaling that it will vote for a UN resolution demanding a ceasefire immediately and unconditionally, I guess one might even say, certainly not without concessions from Hamas, let alone its extirpation. So is that, again, overstating what you're seeing, or does that sound right too?
No.
And again, with the immediate purpose of saving Hamas. It's just, it's hard to overstate how, I believe, strategically ill-advised this is, to say the least. And not just because, clearly, as you said, David, the effect, if not the purpose of doing so, is to jeopardize Israel. And listen, my view is that the least bad thing that can come of that is another October 7th. And that's pretty awful, let's face it. But if emboldened, if empowered, and if aided in such an event in the future by Hezbollah or by Iran itself, this literally poses an existential threat to the state of Israel. And I can't help but note an existential threat to us, if not immediately in due course, and certainly our interests throughout that region. Nobody understands those interests better than you do, David, I think, and we so appreciate your visiting with us to amplify these kinds of concerns. And we have to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to talk with you a bit about another manifestation of this strategic folly by the administration, namely this idea that it wants to create a port in Gaza. We'll talk about what it will be used for by our enemies, among others. Stay tuned. Be right back. We're back. Dr. David Wormser of the Center for Security Policy is in the house. I'm very pleased to say we're continuing our conversation about the Biden administration's ever less concealed hostility towards the state of Israel and its implications. David, one other thing that I want to be very clear about is I think we share a concern that this idea of the United States putting in a port, a temporary port, we're told, in Gaza, ostensibly for the purposes of intensifying the amount of throughput, if you would call it that, of humanitarian assistance to the suffering Palestinian people, may have other purposes and certainly some not very happy repercussions. Talk us through that, if you would, quickly.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that, Frank. This is an important point. The port, first of all, it's rather baffling why one needs the port. There's twice as much food getting into Gaza right now as before the war. There's no food shortage. There's a food distribution issue that is intentionally created by Hamas in order to ensure there's starvation and horrible scenes coming out of Gaza as a form of pressure on Israel. It's a strategic use of their population and their suffering of their population. They're the ultimate enemy of the Palestinians.
This is so important, David, because I mean, it's almost completely unremarked that these guys not only don't care about their people, they are perfectly happy to kill them or have others kill them.
In fact, they strategically use the death of their own people and the suffering of their people. It's an intentional strategy, not just a felicitous byproduct of their strategy. It is the core of their strategy. They hold hostage everybody. Now, that said, this aid is superfluous. One doesn't need to flood it with more food, which is what the port does. One needs to find a way to destroy Hamas so that you can get to a distribution structure, and this port does nothing of the sort. I think it really raises the question. This is not an unobvious. I mean, the United States government knows that this is the case. The Israeli government has made this very clear. The Israeli Elon Levy, who's one of their spokesmen, has made this very clear that there's that much food getting in already. The Israelis now have opened up other paths for food to get in. Again, supply is not the problem. The problem is what? So why are we setting up this port? And I think therein you start getting towards some of the hostility of this administration toward Israel. And I think it has two central aspects to it. One is the fact that you're injecting U.S. forces in a position where it potentially could create an incident between the Israelis and American forces on behalf of the Palestinians. Let alone the fact that Palestinians may kill American forces. And then that all leads to a mess with Israel, a crisis. And this is something that some of the administration officials involved with this, specifically Samantha Power and USAID, who runs USAID, the key official who's in charge of this, she has been advocating for the injection of U.S. troops between Israel and the Palestinians to protect the Palestinians against Israel. And I think this is a backdoor attempt to do that. The second part of it is that we see the Israelis operating in Gaza to create an alternative structure to the two-state solution based on Abu Mazen and the Palestinian Authority, which 80% of Israelis absolutely reject and see as an existential threat to the state of Israel. So they're not going to create a state. But the policy of Washington is a 110% effort in creating a state, a Palestinian state, under Abu Mazen. And that's why they supported Israel at the beginning of the war, because they wanted Hamas removed to make Palestine safe for Abu Mazen, lest one really think that it was entirely ulterior motives to help Israel. No, it was really to make, they saw this as an opportunity to make Palestine safe for Hamas, for Abu Mazen. Well, this port essentially gives America control internally to Gaza over who gets the food and who distributes the food. And more than the food, it's ultimately the reconstruction. And that's where a port matters, because you need large volumes of equipment. And it's going to either come from Israel through Ashdod port, through the Erez crossing into Gaza, which the Israelis would control, or through a port run by the United States in massive amounts of reconstruction, not humanitarian, reconstruction. Who controls the reconstruction will control the standing up of a Palestinian sort of authority in Gaza afterwards. And I think the United States is going to use this port and use the aid, especially the reconstruction, to drive the creation of a Palestinian state in Gaza.
I fear you're right. Though a Palestinian state, I think under all circumstances, is deeply problematic to the security and survival of the Jewish state, but right. Especially under anybody, whether it's Hamas or whether it's, you know, jihadists, Sharia supremacists doing business under so-called Abu Mazen. But just a quick word on Samantha Power, David. This is a woman who has had as a idée fixe long before she got this job, having the United States engaged to protect the Palestinians, as you know. And this is an entanglement that will, I think, cost us very dearly. I did want to ask you about one other prospect, David, that makes this port idea all the more contrary to American interests. And that is that in addition to the distinct possibility that we will lose American lives if the Palestinians decide to shoot them up, and that's always a possibility with jihadis like Hamas, there's also this concern that I happen to share that given that the Biden administration is now surreptitiously bringing people, illegal aliens, into our country through, you know, jet traffic from Latin America and elsewhere, will they use ships from this port to surreptitiously bring in large numbers of Palestinians, all of whom have been, let's be clear, indoctrinated with not only Sharia supremacism, but also, I think, virulent anti-Americanism? This would be a travesty, to say the least, and a great peril. And I fear that that is possibility here too. I can't give you any time to talk about it, David, except to say come back and we'll do it again on another occasion soon. In the meantime, God bless you and the great work you do at the Center for Security Policy. Check it all out at securefreedom.org. Hope the rest of you will join us again next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.